Food. This industry is responsible for what you had for dinner last night, and it's $780 billion in Africa alone. It's a result of complex supply chains from farm to table across businesses, hotels, restaurants. On the Startup Leap today, we're speaking with Tunde Kara of Vendees. Tunde and the team at Vendees are disrupting this food supply chain space and bringing much needed technology, reliability, and finance to these supply chains. They've served over 135,000 farmers, deployed over $90 million since inception, and they processed over 1 million tons of food, helping businesses save $10 million in food waste.
So it helps to minimize waste and bring efficiency of that process where food moves from point of production on the farms, point of consumption.
Learning from the Leap story of this incredible innovation in the supply chain of the food industry in Africa. Grab your headphones, you don't want to miss it.
Welcome to the Startup Leap, the number one podcast interviewing startup founders who have taken the leap into starting their own businesses.
Here on the Startup Leap, we hear real, raw and relatable stories of these entrepreneurs, how they've navigated taking the leap and the decisions they've made. We're your hosts.
I'm Yvonne.
And I'm Maria.
And this is the Startup Leap podcast.
Yvonne and Maria are partners at Local Globe and OpenSeed VC, respectively. Local Globe and OpenSeed are independent of the Startup Leap podcast. Any statements made by Maria, Yvonne, or the Startup Leap guests are solely their view and are not advice. Endorsements by the Startup Leap, its guests, Maria and Yvonne.
Today, we are going to be talking about food, the food market. It is massive across the world in Africa. And the founder we're speaking today is building an incredible technology startup, building in the food supply chain and financing space in Africa. This is an over $780 million market, projected to be over a trillion, not billion, a trillion market by 2030. And they have served over 135,000 farmers in Africa, and they also have deployed over $90 million in credit since their inception. And that's just the beginning. So sit back and relax, and yeah, let's get into it. Welcome, Tunde.
Thank you for having me.
I guess, like, just to kick off, the food industry in Africa, there are many ways you can cut and slice it. I mean, when you hear Africa, you tend to think of agriculture, and a lot of people focus more on the growing and the, you know, planting and harvesting, but you've used technology to pretty much rethink the supply chains from farm to table across hotels, restaurants, and also put a fintech, you know, spin to it by providing financing that these businesses need. How long has been, maybe tell us a little bit about Vendees from your own perspective. What would you say Vendees does?
Okay, so just a bit of context so that we walk into, like, why Vendees is important. If you look at the world's most biggest economies, the underlying thing that powers those economies is credit. Mm. And it is credit through their MSMEs, the small businesses. For Africa, the real gap, when you think about it, is the absence of proper credit infrastructure. Mm. And your typical SME doesn't have access to credit. So instead of the potential that their counterparts in other emerging markets or in more advanced markets have of growth, they're stuck in a position of subsistence because instead of the business to have growth potential, it becomes a business that just finds a way to put money on the table to feed the family. So that's where Vendees comes in. And starting with the food sector, we're helping to build that credit infrastructure that gives small businesses along the most important food value chains in Africa access to credits, and also digitize their workflow. So it helps to minimize waste and bring efficiency of that process where food moves from point of production on the farms to point of consumption at the tables of businesses.
Yeah, and you've gone, I guess the initial product has gone through hotels and restaurants, and how did you kind of think about the B2B side of that value chain?
Okay.
As opposed to maybe like the consumer, which is, I guess, is the larger part of food, subsistence farming, essentially.
I've always leaned towards businesses instead of consumer, even from my background, just working professionally, from marketing to brands. It's so the fascination for me has always been how businesses work, how brands work. So I guess it was just a natural tilt for me to think about this from a business point of view instead of from the consumer point of view. But ultimately, because we do end-to-end supply chain financing, the ultimate end user is still your mom and pop in the house and the kids at the table for dinner. So that I guess that answers your question on how we thought about it from the business angle. A bit of background too. I grew up on a farm.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My parents, they were civil servants, but you know, like, I don't know if there's any Nigerian that doesn't have a side hustle.
So we've talked about this on the pod.
I see.
There's always a side hustle.
So both of my parents, like my mom, growing up, my dad and my mom, up until my teens, probably did at least 10 different businesses that I knew about and I was part of because I had to be a part of it. And one of that is, in fact, my earliest picture was on my mom's farm. So, like, I can remember I was on my mom's farm. So, like, I saw them experience some of the problems that we're solving right now. Because they were small farmers, they grew maize, raised livestock, etc. They, a lot of times, overproduced and there was no direct access to market. And so what will happen is, from my estimates then, sometimes as much as 80% of the harvest will go to waste. And then we'll have to give some to the neighbors and stuff because they couldn't find anybody to offtake them. The most ridiculous one that just got stuck in my head was we used to raise goats at some point. And goats breed very fast. And so very quickly, we had almost like 50 goats and there was nobody to sell them to. And so, So it got to a point where, and you know, when you're raising animals, you have to deal with smell, you have to deal with all this noise. Our neighbors started to complain because it was becoming like a hazard for them. So my dad literally had to look for people to give goats to for free.
And like, do you want a goat?
Leaving so much money in the table.
And there's probably a cost of disposing them as well.
Oh, yes, huge cost because at some point we couldn't even dispose them. So we literally had to go and rent fortunately for us, we had like land that we're not using somewhere and then we put them there, erected a new building. Even that one was not enough at some point. We had to, so like it was just a whole mess. So like that kind of stuck with me. And then when the Vendy's idea started to sort of shape up, I have three other co-founders. My COO co-founder, he grew up on the other side of our initial marketplace because we started as a marketplace. His parents still did run restaurants and hotels in Akure in Nigeria. And he also, like, he had the quote-unquote trauma of working with his parents, handling procurement for them before he went to uni. So he understood that problem of restaurants needing input for their business, like produce, etc., and not either not getting it on time or getting the quality they want or even being able to afford it sometimes. And so it was just like a natural blend of the right co-founders to do this. And I guess it just took off.
Speaking of team, I know that one of your co-founders was your groomsman, and we've had a lot of guests on our show talk about, you know, potentially having friends as team members, benefits and the cons of having that, right? So I'd love to hear about what you were thinking when you brought together the team. Obviously, this is like a highly fragmented space, and so the team is really important. How did you navigate coming together as a team? What was really important to you?
Okay, so I'm one of those guys who believes in the supernatural. Take that how you will. So it wasn't really a bringing the team together as much as it was we just found ourselves and we just sort of fit into the right jigsaw puzzles. I moved into an estate in 2018 in Lagos, and as you have it, two of my co-founders were living there already. In fact, I ended up renting one of the houses that my other co-founder's father built. So it was just like, it was kind of meant to be, and we just had the right backgrounds to do this. So it was really that. And then we started as friends. We used to play FIFA together. They used to play soccer sometimes. And we started another business together, actually. The first one was a media tech, media ad tech business. That's how I actually met Maria.
Yeah.
So it was, funny enough, Uber is not doing it. It was the idea to take advantage of the spaces within ride-sharing apps, in the cabs, like put a screen there, put ads on the app itself. So that was the idea. But it didn't take off, and for many reasons that I talk about later. But that's how we first formed our first working partnership. And so to answer your question, it was really just identifying the people around me who sort of fit the model of what we wanted to work on, and just took advantage of that. There are pros and there are cons to it. The pros are they're your guys. And we've been fortunate because they also have a growth mentality. So we've not had the problem of, as the business has scaled, one or two co-founders are being left behind because they've not scaled with the business. So that problem has not been there. But I know other teams that have had that problem, and navigating that problem can make or break a company. Like, I hear the stories almost every other day. So that has been a pro for us, because somehow we're friends, but the work is the work. Now, part of the pros for that is, because you're your friends, there's automatic trust. So you don't have to deal with issues with, does this person have my back? Because honestly, running a startup is almost like being at war. So a lot of times we think of ourselves as brothers at arms, like literally, like we're in the front lines
together,
like in the trenches, shoulder to shoulder. That's how it feels, and you need somebody beside you who you can trust. You need to be able to trust their decision making. You need to be able to trust that at the very worst, have your best interest at heart. So that's the plus. The negatives are some of the things I talked about earlier. There's a negative of if you don't set early boundaries about what work is and how you want to work, very quickly you will lose the structure and the professionalism that a business needs to grow. So from the very beginning, and I think we also learned this from the first business, from the very beginning, we had a founders agreement. We were very clear about whose role was what responsibilities were, etc. And we, all of us, because one of the things we did wrongly in the first time was we didn't quit our full-time jobs. We wanted to do it part-time. And honestly, from what we know now, trust me, you have to burn those bridges and go in full-time.
So, why do you say that?
Because a startup is like a baby. You, like, literally, it takes up all of your time. Literally. And it takes a lot of intensity. So some of the misconceptions about startups, especially when you read all those Silicon Valley stories, is almost like, oh, somebody has an idea, or he's a smart kid, and then he just stumbles on this brilliant idea and then just executes on it, and people give him money and he works. That's not true. Literally, it becomes your life. Like, even when you are sitting in front of the TV and watching stuff, it is still running a script at the back of your mind, because you're always working. So if you don't give it that level of intensity, you have very little chance of success. And even with that level of intensity, you still have very little chance of success. So you it's almost a non-starter for you not to be fully involved. You need to burn those bridges. And I also think that there's some sort of, I don't know, spiritual thing to it, where when you decide to burn the bridges of full-time employment, or okay, I'm going all in, if this works,
there's a mindset that just comes.
Something just works, and everything just starts to arrange itself for you. So, I think that's important.
And I'm just curious, you mentioned one of the learnings from your previous company. Now, the perception is that second-time founders make better founders because of the learnings that they'll have from their previous company. What are some of the other learnings that you've took into consideration as you've built out Vendez?
There's so many. Let me see. What are the most important ones? Getting validation from other people outside of yourself, maybe investors, actual customers, of your idea before you start to really build for it is extremely important, because very rarely do you start with an idea and by the time you start to execute, even MVP level, if you really talk to the people you want to serve, will that idea remain the same? So that's a big learning for us, because we're just all about this rosy idea. I mean, like, now Uber and Co are executing the thing, so it wasn't a bad idea in itself, but in terms of how we wanted to execute it, I don't know that we had, I think we had very rosy ideas, because...
And it always starts from that, right? Yeah, like, yeah. Ideas need to be lofty to start. They need to be in its raw form. Don't stop that process, but allow it to come close to the light to reality, of reality. Yes, and let's find the middle ground.
So one important, if you want to take bullet points, I don't necessarily... So I'm very careful about giving advice to other people, because... Everybody's startup journey is different. Yeah. So when you listen to podcasts like this or listen to other founders, take it with a pinch of salt. It's like a guidance, because when you start your own journey, or if you're already on your own journey, there are nuances to it. So this is just my own take on stuff. So one of the things that you absolutely need to do is talk to your customers. From the beginning, when you become a billion-dollar company, still talk, like, because... You're building for them and not for yourself.
You can't make assumptions.
Exactly. You need to make assumptions.
You need to test those assumptions.
Or you need to test those assumptions. And it was true for us at the beginning, it's still true for us today. Because I give you we didn't do that for our first idea that crashed. And then when we started Vendy's, we did it to an extent for Vendy's, but then we overbuilt our first MVP. Mm-hmm. And after spending so much time on it, we literally had to scrap it again after just a couple of months. And many people don't know this, which is part of why the startup world or being a founder is not sexy. We built an elaborate system for procurement, etc. Nobody used it. We scrapped it and had to build from scratch. And for like 8 months, we're running Vendy's purely on Excel sheets.
I love that.
And we're making money. It was because there was a problem that was being solved, but nobody knew this until we now built a proper MVP that people now started to use. So that's something else that is, I think founders should also look at, like, especially first-time founders. You need to solve a problem that is so important to your end user that they're willing to use the crappiest solution ever, because the crappiest solution you come up with is better than your current realities. So that's something that helped us.
You know what I just realized? That's the perfect example of first-time founders look at product and the second-time founders look at distribution.
Yep.
It's like people overthink that product thing.
Yep.
And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, the truth is, you actually don't even have a product when you have a first product. You just have something that starts the conversation. Yes. Because immediately they use it, if you're actually even in the right path, then you will hear, oh, that doesn't work. We will definitely need something like that. Then you started, because you're absolutely, I think a lot of founders overthink the product and they don't involve the customers in the design build of the product.
Honestly, so I think it's not just the first time founder problem. I think it's a founder problem in general, because even now, just thinking of our journey when we started in the beginning and where we are now, I think that as a founder, you tend to get towards romanticizing your product and de-emphasizing distribution. And the more experience you get, the more you tilt towards distribution over product. Because even now, we're still rethinking how we do stuff. And now, we're getting more towards channel, like the optimum channel distribution than getting to the customers directly like we normally do now. So I think it's just a learning process. The more you do it, the more you realize product is great, but distribution is king.
Can I... like, just a contrarian view. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some founders, like the Steve Jobs, there are some founders that talk about product, and they're like, it's almost like a belief system. It's like, you have to build something that, you know, people want, that looks beautiful, that...
That's why it's, you know,
I know. And it's like, there's that emphasis. And so I'm wondering, where does that start and where does it end? Because there is, you know, an art to the form of building a product that people use, and it's such a great experience.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Where is it? Is it, does it depend on business model? Like, for example, I'm like, some people are building like maybe consumer businesses. You know, you are building the B2B space. Maybe mm-hmm. B2B companies don't care that much about like, but can you really truly try to want to disrupt a company, like a consumer company today, and you won't care about how your product looks? I don't know. Just yeah. I'm just trying to understand the nuance of...
I think it's finding a balance.
Okay.
As with everything, like it's finding a balance between... Also, what stage your company is at also yeah. matters. Just small anecdotes. I think about a year or two ago, we had grown to a sizable scale. And I was going on about, make mistakes, break things. I'm forgetting that's Facebook slogan now.
Move fast and break things.
And then my co-founder, the CTO, just like during one of the meetings, just called me and like, see, I think we're past that phase now of move fast and break things. Because
you don't want to break things when you have things.
At that point, I think we had like 3,000... restaurants on the about 2,000 restaurants on the platform. If we break anything now, we're affecting 2,000 businesses. So yes, we need to still move fast, but we need to temper it. So just to answer your question about, it depends on what stage you are at. There's a fine blend depending on your stage of product balance and distribution. Early stage, I'll give you an example. Even B2C, I think people over index for beauty and products, finance, all of those things too early when they don't have an actual product that people want. A good example of this is PiggyVest. When PiggyVest started, now they have millions of users.
And who's PiggyVest for those who aren't?
PiggyVest is an African fintech that does, I hope I'm describing.
Yeah, digital savings.
Digital savings.
Like a digital savings
product.
Bank. Yeah.
Well, not bank in itself, but a digital savings product. For middle class Africans, so, and they've grown really big. Like I can't discuss their numbers here because I guess it shouldn't to me in confidence. But they have hundreds of millions of dollars in assets under management. So like, and they started how many years ago? Maybe like 7-8 years ago. When PiggyVest started, it was just an idea of wait. When we were kids, we used to have, I don't know if just that's common
banks,
here
in yeah. Europe,
but piggy banks, exactly piggy banks. I think we used to call them
colos.
Yes,
yeah,
colo. And they're like, we're now adults. We started working. What's the equivalent of a colo for your typical Nigerian early stage employee or mid stage employee? There was nothing like that, and that's how PiggyVest came up. It was not. It was a very, very. It was the app was because I saw the early app. It wasn't great. So my point is like, you need to first index for a solution that people would use, even when it is crappy. Versus go all in to create a beautiful product that nobody ends up using. Yeah.
I love it.
Now, I'm just curious. I mean, I saw that, you know, Bendy's has been referred to as Africa's Amazon Prime for restaurants. As a market... No, let's get into that. I'm really curious why in terms of positioning, but then also given that it's a marketplace, coming back to that MVP... How did you acquire those initial users, particularly small-scale farmers, being a highly fragmented market? Talk to us about the initial acquisition as well.
Okay. I guess this is the 0-1 question. So we are 4 years old. We're 5 years in January next year. So the business has really evolved. So first of all, when we started, we're not dealing with farmers. It was... Literally, the first basic idea before we even thought about Vendy's at all was it started as a side gig. I had a bit of conviction on my end because of my parents' experience. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also a foodie. So I had noticed that several of the restaurants, at the time I was privileged to be leading teams across different cities in Africa. So I noticed that when I'm in Lagos or Accra or Nairobi, like, my eating out experience always varied. Sometimes when I go to the same restaurants after a couple of months of visiting, it's no longer there or the service has depreciated. So I had a bit of conviction there. Olumide, on the other hand, I don't want to go into that because it's a long story, sort of stumbled on these two, and he was in a hotel. the restaurant, the hotel manager was complaining about procurement issues, and then he comes back to me and says, he walks up to him and asks him if he needs solutions, like he needs a what's it called, a procurement company to handle his procurement. I'm like, yeah, as long as you can beat my prices. So long story short is the original idea for Vendy's was a side gig for us because we still have full-time jobs. So it was more like, oh, this is the problem. I'm like, oh yes, actually this is a problem. So we put money together, and then Olumide's wife incidentally was the one who was going to the markets, open markets, to get the first couple of supplies.
Doing things that don't scale.
Right. Yeah, so it was just that we're not thinking about the business. We were just my guy, because at this point we're used to doing stuff together. So it was just that. How we moved from there to the first Vendy's idea was, wait, we did this for a couple of, like, maybe like 3 months. And then we're like, we're tech guys. Why are we not trying to think about how to solve this thing at scale? And so that's how, well, the crude version of how Vendy's started. We got our first customers through our own personal network because nobody believed, like, if the restaurants that use us today saw the idea as useless. Like, why we have staff? If I want to go to the market myself, I'll go to the market myself. Like, they didn't think about the problem deeply enough to see how there were a lot of inefficiencies within their system. So they didn't think that they needed us. And so to prove the validity of the product, we had to use people we knew or people within our network who knew restaurant owners who were willing to give us a part of their procurement to just test it. And that's how we started to validate some of our early ideas. But the thing that just helped the most was, so we, our first order started on the 1st of January 2020, which is why we're exactly 5 years in January. And then 2 months later, we still had maybe two users on the platform. But then 2 months later, COVID happened. And then there was a shutdown. Well, COVID has started in other parts of the world, but it got to Lagos in February, March, thereabouts,
it was
properly.
March 15th that the lockdown happened,
and
I think.
Yeah, the lockdown happened. And the same restaurants that didn't see any point to using us, because we found our way to wrangle a logistics license, we were the only ones that literally could help them buy produce. Because,
of course, because the markets would have been closed.
Yeah. Markets were closed, but they were opened because people still needed. Yeah. But it was selectively.
The need
open.
Was also just exacerbated from before.
And even though people were in their houses, people had figured out that they could order online. So a lot of the restaurants who didn't have online services started to go online. Mm. And then because they now had orders online, they needed to
get
procurement. And that's how we blew from the... We don't need you to... You guys.
We desperately need you.
Do you think without COVID, they might have caught on? Was it a market time? I would love to talk a little bit about that, because two things came up very strongly when you were talking there. One is validating when sometimes maybe the customer doesn't realize the depth of the problem, but where does it start for you to say, actually, I don't want to educate a customer about a problem. If you don't know the problem, then maybe I'm solving the wrong problem. Or is it a situation of you don't know the depth of the problem yet? But in your case, COVID made it abundantly clear.
Yes, yep.
So I'm curious, do you think without COVID, the journey might have been similar in terms of getting that rapid adoption? Or what's your take on that initial validation and, you know, what is true validation of the product sufficient enough to build a business?
Hindsight is, what they say, 2020.
Yeah.
To be honest, I don't think we'll have grown that fast, especially and reached this point now, if COVID didn't happen. And that's because there's certain industries that are stuck in their ways. One is the medical industry, legal industry, food.
Health even.
Yeah, medical health.
Yeah, correct.
Food industry. They are so set in their ways that even with all their obvious inefficiencies, it's very difficult for them to adopt new solutions. So we faced that uphill battle of trying to convince them that this tech was useful for them. But a lot of them didn't see it. Now, in terms of timing, that's why... What I've realized about most founders that I know that reach a certain scale of business is, unlike the assumptions that people have of, oh, he's gotten a lot of success, so he's there has to be a lot of ego, or there has to, like, he's going to feel larger than life. I think the opposite is, I found that the opposite is true.
Like imposter syndrome.
Because the truth is, like, the bigger you get, the more you realize that a lot of luck, a lot of things have to happen in a certain way for you to be successful. So when you recognize that, it kind of humbles you. And then two, as your company grows, the more you know, the less you know.
True.
So that also humbles you, because like as you grow, you're learning new things that you're like, oh my God, how did I survive this
without knowing this?
And then you learn that, and then 2 weeks later, and I'm like, oh my God, how did I not know this? So it kind of humbles you. So back to your question. I think that timing is very important. For instance, like the Uber idea, the ad tech idea.
It's so rampant now.
It's so rampant now. It's so common now. But then nobody was doing
Anytime
it.
I go into a cab and I see the screen, I'm exactly. like, says, yeah. And but this was early. It's yeah, like, so yeah, was, early 20...
This was like 2016.
15 or 16, yeah.
Yeah, there. So timing also matters a lot for founders. So if anybody tells you, oh, like, I'm such a whiz kid, I just figured this out and then I just made it work. That's not true. Mm.
Taking a slightly different direction, one thing I'm really interested in is 2020, article comes out saying every company is a fintech by Angela Strange. And we're seeing a lot of, you know, fintech-enabled marketplaces. I'm just curious, when you set out to build Wendy's, at what point did you think about embedding credit? Because obviously this comes with a number of benefits, such as, you know, reducing friction. A lot of the, you know, suppliers that you have on your platform, they may not have the ability to wait to buyers' credit terms and waiting times and so on. So I'm just really curious around, at what point did you decide to embed credit within your model? And how did you actually go about navigating that? Bringing on the expertise, raising debt?
We're very naive in the beginning, and it's a good thing. I think we're still very naive now compared to where we're going. And from the very beginning, so I'll answer the Amazon Prime question even better now. From the very beginning, because we had like sort of vested interest in the solution being successful because of our backgrounds, we knew what the main problems were, or at least we suspected we knew. And what Wendy started out to solve was access to reliable supply. And with reliable supply, also timing was important, because the earlier example I gave of Olumide talking to that hotel manager, he was talking about an order he should have gotten weeks before. And if you understand Lagos very well, you're calling the supplier and he's like, I'm on my way. He's going to be on his way
next 2 days.
Because what mostly likely has happened is he either maybe hasn't secured the supply, or someone has given him a better offer. So he's delivered to that one, and then he's now trying to sort you out with a separate. So they needed that, and which is why from the very beginning, our initial proposal to them was 48-hour delivery.
Reliability
for quality is etc. Another very key problem that we knew was a problem from the beginning was credit, because part of what we had noticed was these businesses were living literally from quote unquote paycheck to paycheck, because they had to tie down their finances to buy inputs or procure or what's it called? They produce inventory ahead of time. And then by the time they're making their money back, they have to tie down the same income again. So we knew access to credit was important for them. But we thought about it as a value add, as a loss leading value add, instead of something to make money from. So maybe that was a good thing, because it helped us to focus on building an ecosystem that locked them in.
And also gave you the data that you need to do better underwriting to kind of actually create defensibility on the credit piece.
So for that's we started doing embedded banking from the very beginning. Like if you look at our earliest pitches, even to YC, etc., embedded banking was always there. We just didn't think about it as a revenue.
But tell us how you actually did that. Was you working with another lender and writing it off their balance sheet? And at what point did you start writing the risk on your own balance sheet?
So we were working off our balance sheet. So we, again, a lot of luck comes into play here, or background, etc. Somehow, even though we just started out at the time, we had access to pre-seed funding. Small in the grand scheme of things, but I guess not everybody has that access, so I have to recognize privilege. So we before we even started to do this full time, like when me and my other co-founders came together to say, you know what, actually, why don't we build this at scale? So we decided to validate it, unlike the last time where we wanted to do it ourselves and you know, buy the gadgets ourselves, etc. This time we're like, you know what, let's validate it. We put a thesis together, and then we pitched to some of, quote unquote, our uncles, and they're like, oh, cool. Gatsumi, who's my co-founder and chief product officer, just before we started Vendors, was a founder at 54 Gene. I don't know if you know 54 Gene. Yeah. And so he had a bit of that background. One of our uncles, he had pitched to him when 54 Gene started to invest. And he's like, nah, he wasn't interested, but he just didn't see what...
Maybe it wasn't his vibe, because also people,
what's going on here? So 54 Gene had a lot of early success. Mm. And then...
Oh, so the FOMO from that...
He's like,
really,
I'm not missing out this time.
So the FOMO from that helped. So when Gatsumi left to do this with us, so he was one of the guys we approached, and he's like, oh, I missed out on the other one. I don't want to miss out on this one. So he gave us some money, and then... Another, I don't know if they want me to mention them, so I won't talk about their names, but they're pretty big wigs in the fintech space. So one of these other one who invested understands fintech, like you might know him, but yeah. he owns one of the oldest, if not the oldest fintech in Nigeria. So you can go and do your research. So he understands tech, and because the other guy invested, he's like, okay, I'll back you guys too. And so we raised about 100, just converting now, about maybe $120,000, $150,000 pre-seed then. So we had that. So we started to sort of give loans from our balance sheets. But that money ran out very quickly because, like, the scale of the problem was huge. Then we got...
How did you manage credit risk? Did you have any losses in those early days?
Yes, we did. But because the solution was compelling and the value add was compelling... There was very little incentive for you not to pay back.
Mm. And you also had data because you started with an ERP product, yes, right? Like, yes, that helped digitize. Yes. So you could see who actually was ordering, mm-hmm, had ordered, mm-hmm, enough, and all of that probably fed into your model.
Yes.
But still, every model would
have
MPLs.
Did you even have a model?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Like, we're so scrappy. We didn't have, when we started, we didn't have like an algorithm written out or like, but we just... did it based off of, we just looked at how it worked. Okay, so this person spends $1 million every month, and then they pay back after the delivery within 7 days. Mm. So you can trust this person.
So it's like a back of the envelope calculation as to who gets credit and who doesn't.
Like we have now where there's an actual algorithm that credit rates you. It was just really...
like a basic assessment on the ability to pay.
Yeah, basic assessments and ability to pay. Like, oh, we gave you credit and then you didn't pay back for like 30 days, we had to chase you.
Mm.
No, we're not going to take this risk again. So it was just basically that at the beginning. But as we grew quickly, we realized that first of all, we had to hire like proper finance people so that we don't wake up all money. And then we're out of money. Then two, with proper finance people who understood credit risk, etc., we started to put like processes in place for you to access credit. So you don't just come on the platform and then from your first buy, you don't have a credit history, you access credit immediately. So it took us a while. Our first banking partner, just back to the question, our first banking partner was Wemo Bank. I'm giving people a lot of brand recognition here, so people should run my check for that. So Wemo Bank was really helpful because, again, that comes down to a lot of luck and your network, etc., because... the then bank MD kind of knew us. And even though we didn't, like, we just started. Like,
so no cash flow history to be able to do, like,
but
credit.
He just kind of staked his name on it and gave us, I think our initial credit was about 5 million naira. Useless in the grand scheme of things. But it helped us to start building that track record that we needed to access even more credit from the bank as we grew. So a lot of our first... 2 to 3 years, we bankrolled from our books. But now that has flipped. So we now bankroll a lot of it, actually all of it now, through banking partners.
Yeah, and it's $90 million so far. Yeah. And I'm curious, just FX risk. Because that's the thing about credit, right? Especially in a hyperinflationary market where there's high interest rates. and FX volatility. So how did you think about that? How do you think about that, especially as you start scaling the credit piece of the product?
Okay, so we have, I'm not going to share those ones that are like, come on, do the work and figure that out yourself. But we have operational mechanics and also tech that helps to mitigate some of those risks, actually mitigate all of it, so to speak.
So both the FX rate. Do you get your credit in USD or Naira?
So if you know how credit works, for the most part, and that's also something we're actively trying to change in this space.
Yeah.
Because if anybody wants to take anything away from here about what Vendiz is doing, what Vendiz is doing is we're trying to build like proper credit infrastructure that small and middle-sized businesses can use to access credit at scale.
Mm.
So we're also trying to change that culture in Africa with Nigerian banks, especially of you need 120% collateral before you can access credit.
You know, we can talk about this all day.
And we've actually gotten a lot of success there. So what we're trying to build now is the normalcy of a small business, as long as the owners do not have some sort of criminal record, etc., can access credit.
Mm.
Like, good example. My wife did a master's here. And then after she was done, her husband is an entrepreneur, so she registered a company. And in like 2 weeks, she got a mail in the mailbox with an offer for, I think it was like £20,000 of credit or so. I'm like, they don't know you're an immigrant.
Why?
But that's why economies like the UK and the US thrive. Because banks here understand that for them to make money, they need to empower businesses.
Mm.
And when they empower businesses, everybody makes money. And then the government incentivizes that from the top, because you know that for the economy to really grow, yes, we have all the big names of the Shells and the Coal, but the real people who carry the economy are small and medium-sized businesses. And that's what we're trying to change for Africa, starting with food businesses.
To what extent does data unlock that? Because I imagine in the example that you gave, there's probably a credit model that underwrited her as a person and the business.
Yes.
Is that what Vendiz is trying to build for the food industry, like the infrastructure that you're better able to understand? Because the truth is, with credit, it really is about pricing, because as a model, it's your cost of capital and your ability to underwrite risk and the margins that you can make from it. So if you put all three of that together, the underwriting piece is the part, because that's where pricing can go either way, and you can then give someone loans that they should not be getting loans. Mm-hmm. So is that the technology layer you would say that you're trying to build to enable that capital be better efficiently deployed to, you know, grow that SMB ecosystem?
I mean, high level, yes. But as you know, building businesses in emerging markets, especially Africa, means that you're doing many things at the same time. You're literally building different businesses at the same time.
Yeah.
For us to have had this level of success so far, we've had to build the ERP, which if we'd launched in a market like the UK or the US, we might not have needed to build that ERP, even though building that ERP still helps.
Yeah.
So to your question, yes, that technology layer that helps to underwrite is high level what we're building. How we have gone about it might not be the most traditional method. But that's exactly what we're building. And that's why I talk about credit infrastructure, because there needs to be, when I say credit infrastructure, I'm not just saying the finance itself. Like, there needs to be an underlying base of what you build your underwriting on. And for us, that involves securing the inputs to these businesses. That involves gathering enough data about user behavior, etc. That also involves access to credit partners who can now power that. So it's a multifaceted thing, but you're correct. Like, for you to underwrite, you need to be able to build infrastructure that has enough data and enough, data to underwrite the credit that credit risk that you're trying to cover.
Speaking of data, one thing I'm really curious about is your use of data today, because I'm assuming that a lot of what you do, being ERP, is, you know, predictive around inventory, procurement. And so to what extent have you leveraged AI in what you do, if you have at all?
We're on the buzzword, AI.
I mean, we've got to mention it.
Yeah. I mean, like any company that's not taking AI seriously right now is just kind of writing their debt warrant, because like you'd be dead very quickly. So yes, incidentally, so this is why I like to think about a lot of things as serendipity, like stuff just happens, because my co-founder and CTO, Wale, before he joined us, used to run his own business, and he was a consultant for IBM on their Watson product. So from the very beginning, we're very machine learning conscious. From the very beginning, I mean, nobody was calling it AI then. Like
it was machine learning. Yeah,
so from the very beginning, and that's what influenced some of like how we underwrote credit, how we, so there's a lot to, like, and I like it this way because it doesn't put too much attention on or give us too much pressure. Like Vendis is very technology based. A lot of people assume is logistics, and people just, because even with, just to your point on machine learning, we've engineered the product to the point where even our logistics partners and the vans and trucks that we that run through the platform are mapped, and like we know what the time of deliveries are going to be. Like everything is planned. There's an algorithm that runs all of that. So from like timing the orders, like what day of the order, what time is going to be, when it's going to get there, and that's why we can now fulfill our same day delivery promise. So a lot of Vendis is based off of machine learning, just learning the user behavior, learning delivery patterns, learning what parts of the city will have congestions at what time of the day, and planning around that, where to put your warehouses, so that from like depending on the heat map of where the orders usually come from, so that you can shorten the time of when it leaves the warehouse. So a lot of that has to do with machine learning and AI. So yes, Vendis does a lot with AI. But when I say AI, I'm not talking about LLMs, like a lot of people talk about, but yes, we do.
Do you manage the logistics yourself? And how has that changed over the last 5 years since you started? Because obviously back then, I'm assuming like logistics was a lot tougher to manage. There's a lot of friction within it. So just curious, you've mentioned that you've built out these, you know, systems to enable you to, you know, map out where and when you want to pick up some of these deliveries and so on. But just tell us how you're managing those deliveries and logistics.
When we started, we started as the naive idea for a Nigerian market or for an African market of being a pure marketplace. Yeah, like 2 weeks into that, we're like, yeah, this is not going
to
work.
Why did you get to that conclusion?
Because, so our promise from the beginning, like I said, was 48-hour delivery, assured quality, etc. So we'd have scenarios where people place an order on the platform and then it's delivered to the user and they're like, no, this is not what we ordered. Or no certain quality, and then there'll be disputes because
and it's perishable goods.
Yes, some of it's FMCG, but a lot of it is perishable, and so there'll be disputes, and then Vendis will have to bear the costs. So very quickly,
and it's not a great user experience.
Yeah,
well,
it's a terrible user experience. So very quickly, we're like, you know what? If we want to stay in business, we need to figure out logistics. And I remember then because when we didn't have enough money, a lot of money, so like
only 100 and something seed round.
So like every single penny or dollar we spent was important. So like I remember there was a lot of pushback on getting our first couple of bikes, but we couldn't trust third party providers on those issues because they were failing us. Like sometimes we'll have logistics partners where the delivery is supposed to get there and then it doesn't get there.
Where is the logistic partner?
They themselves don't know where their bikes are. So it was just a whole mess. So we just say, you know what? If this business is going to succeed, we need to pull this in-house. We'll go through the pains of learning it and then figure it out. We've always used Amazon as a benchmark or as an example of how we operate. And we're like, you know what? Amazon had to pull this in-house after a while. So like, you know what? Maybe that's what we need to do. So and that's what we did. And what has happened over the last 4 years is because we're very data driven, we've now figured out how to run that properly. We've also figured out how to run it and manage others.
How to outsource it properly. Yeah, because now you have the visibility and the process that you've designed that you couldn't have designed if you didn't bring it in-house.
Yes.
Interesting.
So While we started as 100% outsourced logistics and delivery, and then we quickly moved into 100% handling our logistics, etc., we've now moved to about 80 to 90% outsourced and then just 10% in-house. Now, the 10% that's in-house is because that 10% has to do with the cold value chain. So, like, chicken, all those things. We still don't have enough expertise on ground to handle that at scale. And that's why we're still handling that in-house. But the ultimate goal for us is to just hand it out and just manage all of that through in-house.
I think that's really interesting because as the business has grown, scaled and evolved, you've gone from doing it yourself to outsourcing it. And there's nuances even between markets, right? Because if you look at some of the B2B marketplaces in the UK, for example, they'll just tend to outsource logistics from day one.
Yeah.
However, if you want to ensure the quality on the continent and so on, then managing that in-house is pretty key.
But would you say that over time evolving, if you were to start Vendees today, would you say that the infrastructure has developed enough for you to at least have a larger portion outsourced now compared to 5 years ago?
Yes. Yes, it has. But the only reason it has evolved, quote unquote, is because other businesses like ours took it up to sort of figure out the problem. I'll give you an example. Like when Paystack started, there were no Paystack is a payments platform, Stripe. The number of businesses they service now were not even existing then.
Yeah.
The number of transactions they do now per day, they could not do in a whole year because there were no businesses online doing those things. So I guess like businesses like ours create a network of enablement.
So it's like market creation businesses,
That creates enable. So some of the businesses that work with us now, like there's a business that we're beginning to sort of outsource some of our cold value chains to. Literally just started and they're getting better because they work with us. We've gone to the point where we even use gig workers for delivery. And like so Uber drivers, Bolt drivers get on the platform and we can manage that. So it like the onus is on businesses like ours to create that enablement. So yes, if we started now, if Vendees started now, there's opportunity not to do those things because those things are, to be honest, like time consuming.
Yeah. They're distracting as well. You're like, this is not the business I set out to build. Yeah.
So our counterparts in developed markets have the luxury to just start with a single idea.
Exactly.
That's a horizontal.
Yeah.
And then have different partners in different verticals that help them to help their own business succeed. We don't have that. Most times when you want to build a business at scale in emerging markets, you're building multiple businesses
at the same time.
It's a problem, but if you figure it out, it becomes the moat that prevents other people from getting into your space and taking market share.
I love it. I wanted to ask about like just dynamics around like marketplace and network effects and how you thought about that. But I don't know if that was something that really occupied your mind in the early stages, because I think the concept of defensibility is very different in nascent markets where you're a pioneer compared to other markets where there's either more capital, you know, and, you know, more efficient infrastructure to easily disrupt. So I'm wondering, at what point in the business did you start thinking, especially being like a marketplace-esque type product, did you start thinking about defensibility in the long run? Like, did it at any point come to mind that, oh, can someone else like build something and get enough capital and create an edge that you didn't secure early on? And did you think about, you know, network effects? Did you think about, is there a way we can design our business model that allows us just be harder to displace because we get into so many customers who in turn get us many customers? I don't know. Any tips, you know, or thoughts there would be?
So because I've always been like, because I talked earlier about why we did B2B, I've always been somebody who's curious about businesses and large businesses, etc. I always wanted to build a large business. So yes, I always thought about network effects. Maybe not in the most practical terms, but it was also always something that was there. Like, in fact, when you start talking to investors from the early stage, even then they tell you, oh, chicken and egg.
Yeah.
Oh, so which one do you get first?
Yeah.
So like we thought about it, but maybe not in the most practical way. I think, to your point, when we actually started to execute on Vendees, it was more of a, we tried this, it doesn't work. It was just doing what works and then just going with it. Because when we started and we're thinking about it academically, okay, so who do we go for first? Should we go for the suppliers so that we can get the users? And then as that grows, the multiplier effect starts to... At the end of the day, when people ask us how we solve that problem, I can't really say, because I think both of them just sort of figured themselves out. Mm-hmm. Because when we first approached the suppliers, we couldn't get credit from them because who are you? Mm-hmm. Where are you coming from? Why should we give you our products for on credits? Why should we give you special discounts, etc.? So I guess technically we ended up amassing the users, but it wasn't really what we set out to do. We ended up amassing the users, and then with the buying power that we had, we could now influence supply. Now, and that, to your point, has created the network effect. So I'm answering it this way because it wasn't like we figured out that if we unmasked the users, that's what's going to get the suppliers. We actually thought that if we went to the suppliers and got discounts, then the users would see a need to use us.
It's like the catch-22 problem of a marketplace.
But what we figured out when we started to actually do the work is the problem for the users was so grave that they were willing to pay us even more just to solve that problem for them and access credit, etc., while we figured out how to get it for cheaper than optimizing for the cheapest product. So that's why I answered it that way, because I don't want people to obsess too much about, oh, should I figure out what side of the marketplace, or no, just get in there, start to do the work, and then you will figure it out along the way. And to your point about the multiplier effects, as we gathered more users, we got more credit from and discounts from the suppliers, more users saw the value, and then ripple effect, like it just, and then word of mouth, it just, like everything just kind of spiraled.
Yeah.
COVID-2 was a big, it had a big multiplier effect on us, because people who couldn't do the procurement themselves anymore, they heard about what Vendis was doing. Okay, let's try it. You try it. You have a restaurant friend who also is having the same problem. We didn't do any marketing in the beginning.
Really?
Zero. Wow. And in our first year, without launching publicly, we only launched after we got into YC. We had gotten to profitability. We're from the very beginning, because we didn't have money. We all
it wasn't that
was top of mind.
Top of mind. Like, we needed to make enough revenue to pay the rent. Mm. We needed to make enough revenue to pay staff. Even though as founders, then we're basically earning nothing. But that needed to keep going. So, and by the time we did that for like 7 or 8 months, we broke even and we were profitable. So that had always been like top of mind for us. Like, it wasn't we didn't have $1 million to just be throwing about.
Yes, I just want to talk a little bit about your team and how you've scaled. How many people are in the company now?
About 250 thereabouts.
Really?
Yep.
It's a big company. Wow. A big team.
Grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
But still small, but yeah.
And this is why I'm asking this question, because that's probably the largest team you've had to manage to date.
By far.
Now, how did you think about scaling culture? How did you think about going from you and the founding team and maybe a very core, motivated group of people? There's a lot of emphasis on 0 to 1 sometimes, but there's 2 to 200. Like, how did you think about that structure, culture? Any tips, tricks, things in retrospect that you were like, now I know better. If I, could do it again, I would do it that way. Yeah, would love for you to share some of those with us.
First off, again, back to the point of there's no, like, anybody that comes to you and sells you the story of, oh, building a successful story is because you're a whiz kid and you're so smart, you just figure it out. It's just selling you a lot of bollocks. Nobody can build any wild dream without convincing other people to come on that journey with you. So I'm very grateful to our 260 staff, because they're a team of true believers.
Mm. Like, you call them ants. Yes. Like, you have this ant colony. Yep. Give it to us. I would love to, to hear.
So I'll get into that.
Yeah. Now.
So culture essentially is usually an extension of the founders or the founding team. Because if you think about different organizations, both international and local, you can tell what the culture will be like just by looking at the founding team. And that's where all of this comes from. There's something that I started to pay attention to, like, maybe a couple of years ago, like 2 or 3 years ago. It's called the reality distortion field. And I stumbled on it reading about Steve Jobs. So according to, I think his name is Isaac Watson, the guy that wrote his biography, Steve Jobs had like a force field around him that sort of bent the will of people around him to believe in his ridiculous ideas. And then those ridiculous ideas turn into reality. And since I found out about that, I've started to do a bit of study on it. And I realized that every founder has that or needs that to an extent if you need to grow, like if you need to solve a big problem. And that's what brings a lot of people, draws the people that you need to build that dream to, with you. And then that's what builds your culture. For us, like you mentioned, I've always loved ants. Like my first,
I've always loved ants.
Yep. And now my son loves ants too. So
anyways, that's on that. Generational. Yep.
I've always, in fact, my first dream as a kid was to be a zoologist. Until my mom asked me, I remember this conversation where she's like, how do you want to feed your family? And quickly, because money was very important for us, yeah, for us growing up. So very quickly, I disabused my mind of it. But I still loved insects especially, but animals in general. And so, like, when we started Vendy's, we're just thinking about, like, how do we create a culture of people who are working as a team? And even though we're small at the time, who were ready to take on the world's biggest problems. And then it just clicked to me. My favorite ants in the world, as I don't know if that's what they call them here, but they call them soldier ants, driver ant columns. They're like, if you lived in Nigeria, like they're like, I think the local name for them is Ijalo. Like those things are ridiculously aggressive.
And efficient.
Like if a driver ant column walks in, like if a colony of them gets into this place, everybody's leaving because they'll be up the walls. They will kill animals bigger than them. It is so. I remember playing with them because again, I grew up on a farm. So I remember playing them as a kid. Like they would bite me. I'll figure out how to reroute them. Like it was fun thing for me. So I remember that. I'm like, oh my god! Like actually, these guys are small, but I've seen documentaries where they ransack villages.
You can small just and Google. Mighty.
Yeah, small but mighty. So it just became like a natural sort of, I don't know, waypoint for us to say, okay, you know what? An ant colony was still small, but we're going to take over the world. And that has been true because we have staff who have been with us for about 4 years, and they've seen us grow from one tiny small office to where we are right now. So when we talk about the ant history or the ant colony, the Vendant colony, they understand what it means because they literally
it's personal. Have seen it. They've
it's,
seen
it's
it, yeah.
It's personal, and they pass that culture to the new guys as they come into the company.
One of the things we like to do before we wrap up is just ask a question. Time machine. If you were to go back 5 years before you started Vendy's and give yourself one piece of advice, what would that be? In one sentence.
Easier ways to make money.
Word. I feel like entrepreneurship is like the ghettoest way. Yeah. The risk is so high.
Oh my god.
And I think
the payoff is also high.
I mean, if everything
aligns.
The problem for people like us is there are easier ways to make money, but those ways are going to bore me to death.
Yeah.
So
it makes it worth it.
Yeah, it makes it worth it. Like the fun about this is not the money. Contrary to what most people believe, the fun about this is seeing something that was just an idea in your head start to influence the lives of literally hundreds of thousands of people in 4 years. That tickles me in ways that you can't even believe. So it's not really about the money, and I won't get this from a regular 9-to-5. I was talking to somebody the other day, and there was this chat about how much founders earn, etc. Does it make sense? And it was funny to me because I'm like, what I earn now, I was earning way more in private when I was working for other people. And if I was still there, I'll be earning double what I... So it really is not the money. Of course, there are unlimited upsides. Mm. Like I have, like I'm way wealthier in equity, etc. Yes. But again, that's still paper money type of thing. So it's... It really is about those upsides. So when I say there are easier ways to make money, it's a joke, but there really are easier ways.
It's a reality as well.
I love it.
But it depends on what your priorities are.
Yeah. And one more question. If you were not building Vendy's, what would you be doing?
most likely something else, building something else. Because, again, part of my background is like, I didn't notice this until recently, but even from when I was a kid, my grandma was in procurement. It was one of my founders that actually pointed this out.
Your grandma was in procurement.
Yeah, like so my grandpa was one of the top, it was almost a DG level for FIRS. Mm-hmm. So he was pretty wealthy. My grandma refused to be a stay-at-home wife. She was one of the biggest distributors of, I don't know if you know the Ibro family, of fish, because they like it. So, and then she also used to distribute, because I remember some of they are very foggy memories, but I remember going with my grandma to nightclubs at night. And
that is a sentence combination I did not think was going to happen.
And then we're there because you know how certain members just sticking.
Yeah, out. Yeah.
We're there to deliver drinks, alcoholic drinks. I don't know how appropriate that was, but I actually remember those are part of my early memories. So I guess it's always been part of me.
So you have to build, like you can't not build. Yeah. So you wouldn't go into employment or something.
Yeah. When I was at Ringier, I started a company within the company. Mm. Like so, I'm just that person.
Yeah.
So if I wasn't doing Vendis, I'd probably be doing something else.
And just looking back at
your journey, are there any resources that you've used, books that you've read that really stood out to you?
Well, this is probably controversial.
Oh gosh.
This is probably controversial because a lot of people have really, what's the word now, poo-pooed this book.
Yeah.
But honestly, if I pointed to one book that's not religious that influenced my career as an entrepreneur, it is Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Really?
Yep.
Interesting.
A lot of people now, Robert Kiyosaki has a lot of.
Yeah, he didn't age. Like, that didn't age well.
But for some reason.
It was so inspirational at the time.
But for some reason, the book is those still principles really impactful, right?
Yeah.
Work.
Yeah.
Other people's time, other people's money. Like, yeah. Like just. I It's a book that my kids are going to read.
Yeah.
Rich Dad Poor Dad, the cash flow quadrant. Yeah. The principles, I don't know where he got them from because obviously now it turns out that there was no Rich Dad or any Poor Dad. He was just. But
just dads.
But wherever I got those principles from, God bless him, because they actually do work. Yeah. So ignore the messenger, focus on the message.
I love it.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tune into another episode of the Startup Leap, TSL for short. Leave a review, tell us what you think of this episode on all our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guest. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.